As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
How does a tactical relationship, a transactional relationship, become strategic? Because this is really an interesting case of that happening. A very simple arms transaction. Russia needed munitions. And initially they did it through the Wagner Group. But now this has ended up in a relationship where they not only have a security treaty, but on August 15th, the 80th day of Korea's liberation, the head of the Russian Duma came to North Korea. Putin had a phone call with Kim. They're behaving like close strategic allies.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel United States Army, retired, and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 51, North Korea's Wartime Windfall, a dialogue with Dr. Victor Cha. Russia's war in Ukraine has profoundly altered the global strategic landscape, not just in Europe, but across the Indo-Pacific. And at the center of this shift is a regime long viewed as isolated, constrained, and increasingly irrelevant, North Korea. In the early months of the invasion, few would have imagined that Pyongyang would have become one of Moscow's most vital war suppliers. But that's precisely what has happened. As we speak, North Korean shells are fueling Russia's assault. What began in late 2022 as a covert arms transfer has now become a formal military alliance, cemented in a defense treaty signed in June 2024. The numbers are staggering. North Korea is believed to have supplied over 6 million artillery rounds, nearly half of Russia's total wartime consumption, along with tactical missiles, long-range rocket systems, and thousands of troops and laborers. In return, Kim Jong-un has secured billions in cash, access to sensitive technologies, and a strategic alignment that not only props up his regime, but also undermines the global sanctions system. For years, the dominant narrative about North Korea was one of stagnation, failed diplomacy, economic decay, and tightening isolation. But that narrative no longer holds. Pyongyang is not merely surviving, it is maneuvering strategically, globally, and profitably. And the implications are profound. This wartime windfall may make North Korea less willing to engage in denuclearization talks, less reliant on China, and more emboldened to act with impunity. The United States and its allies now face a strategic dilemma. Traditional tools, diplomacy, deterrence, and containment, are proving inadequate in a world where Kim Jong-un has new patrons, new profits, and new leverage. To help us make sense of this moment, I'm honored to be joined by one of the world's foremost experts on Korean security and geopolitics, Dr. Victor Cha. Dr. Cha is the president of the Geopolitics and Foreign Policy Department and Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He also serves as distinguished university professor, Daesung KF Chair, and professor of government at Georgetown University. He served on the National Security Council, was deputy negotiator for the six-party talk, and is the author of numerous acclaimed books on North Korea and the Indo-Pacific. I'm also proud to share a professional connection with Dr. Cha. In 2008, we both contributed to the book, North Korea Country Study. We were each one of five contributors to that volume. He wrote the government and politics chapter, and I had the honor of writing the national security chapter. In today's episode, we'll unpack what North Korea has given Russia, what it's gotten in return, and what it all means for diplomacy, deterrence, and stability in the Indo-Pacific. Victor Cha, welcome to Dialogue.
My pleasure to be with you, James.
Oh, it has been long coming, but I am excited to have you in the studio. You have an amazingly profound history in this field. I wonder if you might just talk a minute about how you came, what's your story? How did you come into this?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, it's a pleasure to be on the dialogue with you and to be with you here at APCSS. So my entry into the North Korea field really didn't happen until, I would say, 10 years into my academic career, as you know, I've been an academic by training. That's my primary identity. I've spent some time in policy working for the US government, but it's largely been in academia. And I started to write about North Korea from a public policy context soon after I got tenure, promoted to associate professor with tenure at Georgetown. And there was some crisis going on with North Korea at the time. So I wrote, decided to write an op-ed, submitted it to the New York Times. They took it. And the funny thing about that is, once you write something in the New York Times, everybody thinks you're an expert all of a sudden, even though that's not true. After that, I started doing more research on North Korea, their strategies, how it affects alliances, these sorts of things. And that's how I came into it. When I ended up working in the government on the National Security Council, Korea was part of my portfolio, but at the time, we didn't really know whether we were actually going to get into denuclearization negotiations, but we did, and I did that for 3 years, three very intense years. And that is really a lifetime's worth of experience on North Korea, working with allies, working directly with the North Koreans, traveling to North Korea, meeting them in China, meeting them in Europe, meeting them in different places. And that's when I felt like I had more than the average understanding of North Korea. It was only after that experience. And then I wrote a couple of books about the topic. And but it's the sort of problem, as you know well, James, that doesn't solve itself. It's one of the most difficult problems out there in the US foreign policy, in the US foreign policy agenda.
Perhaps in the words that you used before, maybe it's an impossible state.
Yeah, it's impossible in certain respects. I think my editor for that book chose the title largely not in part because it was such an intractable foreign policy problem, but in part to capture this, this enigma of a North Korea when every other regime like it had collapsed, that it was still around.
Maybe you'll share whatever amount you feel comfortable with, but I know you've got the summit is coming up between Presidents Trump and Yi, and that'll be next Monday, right?
Yes,
And so
yes.
you're going to head back for that, and maybe you might just fill us in a little bit what we might think about with this coming up. It's an important summit.
Yeah, clearly, very important summit. First meeting between the new South Korean president and President Trump. For those of us who watch this carefully, generally, when we see a matchup between a more progressive South Korean president and Republican US president, sometimes there are some fireworks. Hopefully that won't be the case this time. I think both, I mean, President Lee is a very talented politician. President Trump has a very clear agenda when it comes to Korea, whether we're talking about security or trade. They're just coming off of a trade framework agreement. So I think they both want this meeting to go well, and I expect it will. But it could be transformative at the same time. They could make agreements on things having to do with the alliance, having to do with North Korea, having to do with South Korean investments in shipbuilding and other sorts of things in the United States that could really change the overall relationship.
I think if I was putting money down on this, we will see something of consequence coming out of this on Monday. I don't know what, but I would, it won't be just doldrums. I would be surprised.
I agree with you. I mean, I think there's always a tendency for the bureaucracies on both sides to want to make sure that the atmospherics are good, that there are good optics that come out of the meeting, but don't press too hard on too much groundbreaking substance because it's difficult to negotiate that in
It
the
is.
run-up to the summit. But we're talking about a very different type of summit meeting. I mean, President Trump, is making a lot of the decisions on the
Yes,
spot.
he is.
And so that could potentially happen in this case too.
Yeah. Let's pull us into this these points we want to talk about here.
Sure.
And I want to consider the tactical to the strategic. I mean, and I kind of laid it out, but Russia's war in Ukraine has transformed Korea from this marginal player into a strategic partner. So here's a question. How did a quiet arms relationship evolve into a formal defense alliance?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think we've talked about this before. Like, it's an interesting empirical question. It's an interesting theoretical question, right? How does a tactical relationship, a transactional relationship, become strategic? because this is really an interesting case of that happening. A very simple arms transaction. Russia needed munitions, and initially they did it through the Wagner Group.
I did.
But now this has ended up in a relationship where they not only have a security treaty, but on August 15th, the 80th day of Korea's liberation, the head of the Russian Duma came to North Korea. Putin had a phone call with Kim. This is, they're behaving like close strategic allies. How and why this has happened? I mean, one of the reasons clearly has to do with material need on both sides. Russia needed munitions for the war. North Korea needed a lot of things coming out of the COVID lockdown, everything from food and fuel to weapons to cash. But then it took really leadership on both sides to try to take this and turn it into something that was longer lasting. And I think this was a proactive choice by both sides. I think the initiative came from the North Korean side. But at the same time, Putin has always had some interest. Like if we look at the Russian leaders over time, Soviet and Russian leaders over time, Putin was always distinct, and he had some reason that he felt like he wanted to personally engage with the North Korean leader. We saw him do it with Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, and we see him doing it with Kim Jong-un.
Pull on this a bit. Let's talk a bit about arming the Kremlin. And so North Korea, I mean, as I mentioned, they supplied millions of shells and advanced missiles, thousands of troops to aid this Russian war effort. So what does this unprecedented scale of military support, what does it reveal about Pyongyang's capabilities and its intent?
Yeah. Well, in terms of capabilities, it shows that they have massive stockpiles of ammunition. One thing the war in Ukraine has told us is that nobody has enough ammunition.
This is true. And I think they actually, initially, you heard about the dud ratios and stuff. I think, they're pulling out of their 1970s and 1980s
right,
stock.
Right.
But they must be way through that by now.
Right. They must be way through that right now. And I think it was one of the studies that we did at CSIS showed that their munitions industry is operating at full tilt, full capacity right now. Undeniably with support from the Russians. It's hard to document that, but it's hard to imagine they wouldn't be doing this otherwise. There must be co-production taking place right now. So they're, they've got rid of their old stockpiles. They've replenished them for themselves. Yep. They're producing more for the Russians. So I think in terms of capabilities, this is a net win for North Korea, undeniably. But the intent question is really important because I think it really shows that North Korea is not content to sit on its hands. Yeah. There was once a thesis out there that said, basically, if you leave them alone, they're not going to bother anybody. If you leave them alone and don't threaten them, they're not going to bother anybody. Yeah. But, we've seen here that they are being very proactive about taking advantage of strategic situations where they see an opening. And again, our understanding based on the open source only is that it was Kim Jong-un's idea to propose munitions, troops, because he saw that Putin needed them. So in terms of intent, I think it shows, I mean, unfortunately, it shows, I think, that North Korea's ambitions are not status quo, that they are revisionist, that they are looking to improve their position vis-a-vis the United States, vis-a-vis China, Russia, vis-a-vis South Korea. And we just can't expect that they're going to sort of sit in their box and not bother anybody if nobody bothers them.
You talked about the Russians helping them. And I was reading this morning in Kiev Independent and talked about how the intelligence chief was talking about how the Russians have assisted them in upgrading the K-23 so that it is much more capable. Its circular error probability is greatly reduced. And I'm thinking, they've got the defense industrial base is massive, right, in North Korea. I mean, some 200 companies, tens of thousands of people that work in there. And I imagine the Russians must have a place in that right now. Since they're a consumer, they want to make sure the product coming on their side is as refined as it can be.
Right, yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, we don't have full view into all these things. We can only work with what we can see from the sky.
That's right.
Based on commercial satellite imagery. But one would certainly expect that the Russians are not going to, they're not just going to want to buy like North Korean duds. They're going to want to have the best quality that they can possibly get. And I think that this relationship, this in particular this production arrangements that they've created. I don't think that's stopping if there's the if the war stops in Ukraine. I mean, I think again, everybody has learned from this war that munition is key. Munitions are key. And it's not just what you have now, but it's what you will need in the future. And so I think that this relationship is here to stay.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
I talk a little bit about this sanctions bypass, and you've written about this as well. But rail lines and maritime routes, I mean, they've created this wartime pipeline that is linking North Korea factories to the Russian front line. And so here's a question: how are North Korea and Russia successfully evading sanctions to reinforce their war economies? How they're
Yeah.
doing that?
So I think there are two elements to this. The first is what they're doing on the ground. As you said, they've created basically a supply chain system now where we see on land at the railway crossings, we see very clearly refurbishment of all these railway car crossings, a great deal of commerce on both sides in the customs area. These used to be areas where there was literally nothing happening, had not been used in a long time, really no activity, no traffic. We're seeing bustling traffic. We're seeing, containers full of stuff in the customs areas. We're seeing them build new road infrastructure connecting to these railroads. So that's clearly something that's taking place. The other thing that we and others have been tracking is by ship. The movement of material from Nanjing Port across over to Vostochnoye and some of the other ports, and then making their way by land over to the war front. So this is a supply chain that they've created that is robust, and that, from a Western perspective, in terms of evading sanctions, is very effective because all of this is tucked up very deep into North Korean and Russian territory, in some cases directly on North Korean land, Russian land. So if we think about PSI type of counterproliferation intervention activities, very hard to do, right? Very hard to do. So that's at one level. At the other level is that, as you know well, as a result of the six-party talks, there were 11 UN Security Council resolutions levied against North Korea. In particular, Resolution 1718 was the backbone of the UN sanctions regime because it set up the panel of experts, which was in basically an enforcement body, monitoring enforcement body, to ensure that UN member states were complying with the UN sanctions. Russia has effectively dismantled all of that. And certainly, this was related to their cooperation with North Korea in the war in Ukraine. Russia chose not to renew. It required the UN Security Council all to agree to renew Resolution 1718, which meant dissolution of the panel of experts. I met members of the panel of experts as they were leaving to go back to their home countries. And so that has effectively gotten rid of the enforcement regime. And Russia has said that they're not complying with sanctions. And China, for the most part, we feel like aren't complying either. So at both levels, both in terms of what they're doing on the ground and also in terms of the sanctions institutions, these have all been dismantled.
UNSCR 1718, it was almost 20 years ago. I mean, this was put in place from the first nuclear test, right? Detonation in October of 2006. It had been with us for some time that you're talking about the
And they did really good work. I mean, we would, so as you know, we do a lot of commercial satellite imagery work, and they would be in our distro list, and they would come and visit us in DC because they had questions about things. I mean, they were doing really serious work and research and trying to understand how the North Koreans were evading sanctions. The Biden administration, at the end of the administration, tried to set up something trilateral among the US, Japan, and Korea that would serve as sort of an imperfect substitute. But certainly it's not achieved what the panel of experts used to
No,
achieve. Yeah.
not at all.
Yeah.
You're talking about the supply chain, and to give some context, so in 1999, so about 26 years ago, I flew in on Vladivostok Air, went into Vladivostok there into Primorsky Krai, and I talked to different people. So I'm talking with the government people. I said, "So when are you going to, connect this rail line?" And for a long time, they've been talking about this, but it took this effort here to really move them forward, right? I mean, you've described it and things you've seen, but they lacked, the real initiative to make this thing happen. And now that it's going, it is something to contend with. Yeah. I want to pull a little bit more than talking about, Kim's windfall. I mean, with earnings amounting to $10 billion or more, Pyongyang is securing hard currency. And this is without a doubt a cushion to the regime. So here's a question: how might this wartime windfall affect North Korea's domestic stability and its external behavior?
So in terms of domestic stability, if we accept the thesis that the reason North Korea has been able to survive as long as it has is because the regime has enough to keep the 1 million or so elites and military happy, then getting somewhere between $6 to $12 billion of hard currency from this relationship with Russia is certainly not hurting them, right? It's certainly helping them in that respect. There is, it's, you know, the economic situation, I think, for North Korea is also improving, not necessarily just because of the war economy that they're running with the Russians, but the closeness of that relationship has caused the Chinese to return their bilateral trade with North Korea to pre-pandemic and even exceeding pre-pandemic levels. So, their desire not to be squeezed out of the DPRK-Russia relationship has caused them to increase their own economic interaction with North Korea, and certainly that's benefiting the North Korean economy, which probably translates into political stability as well. So I think these things are really helping them a great deal. The only thing that I think we don't have as clear a handle on is, as you know well, I mean, they've suffered a lot of losses.
Yes.
And at first, they were keeping these secret from the public. So we were getting anecdotal reports that the citizenry was angry that they didn't know that their sons were being sent to Europe to fight a war. And so there was some anecdotal evidence that there was some societal disruption as a result of this. But we've seen how the North Korean leadership and the Russians have turned this around. They have since then publicized, since they were successful in taking back pieces of Kursk, they've now publicized that North Korean troops are fighting alongside of Russia, and they've talked about them as victorious and heroes. So they've really gone public with the narrative now that they feel that they've accomplished their military objective for the most part, and they are now celebrating these as heroes in the history of the DPRK-Russia relationship. When Putin talked to Kim Jong-un on August 15th, this was exactly the message that they sent and that they released. And then there's that famous, now famous, I guess, picture of Kim Jong-un receiving the coffins with the North Korean flag draped on them, showing grief and remorse at the same time of talking about how proud he was of these fallen soldiers. So they've tried to rewrite a narrative there that is not unfamiliar to people in the West when we think of our own sort of wars and the fallen. It's not clear how much that has changed the way some in society feel, but I think if anything, this war has probably made Kim Jong-un even more strong at home and abroad.
Oh, that's fascinating. I think you're spot on. I remember talking with people early in this and, debate on whether or not how this cohort of soldiers would or would not be welcomed back into North Korea. And I was convinced from the beginning that they would, in fact, garner all the lessons learned out of this they could. And there are significant changes in tactical fighting and stuff that are going on, and I think that they're probably going to really be at the leading edge of some of this these lessons learned, and they're going to adapt, and they're going to
Yeah.
I don't know if you're.
Yeah. I mean, you know that stuff much better than I do. You know, I'll just say that I think, you know, the North Koreans are not stupid, but they are cut off from the outside
They
world.
are.
So anytime they have an opportunity to learn, anytime they have an opportunity to learn, they make the most of it, whether it's from a failed missile test or, you know, whether it's from a visiting delegation from Europe. Every bit of information they can get from the outside world, they make the most of it and they learn the most from it. And so this experience that they're having now in Ukraine, whether their soldiers are dying or whether they're not dying, what they're learning from the Russians in terms of tactics, yeah, I think they are learning a lot from that. And there should be no sense of or no lack of concern that the North Koreans on the peninsula are going to be a much more formidable force as a result of their participation in this war. Yeah.
I wrote in an earlier book, North Korean People's Army. That was quite a few years ago now, but how Kim Il-sung in December of 1950 had gathered his people together and said, okay, this didn't go like we thought. We need to figure out how to, change direction if we're going to be successful here on the battlefield. And so they have been a learning organization from the beginning.
Right,
I wholly
right.
agree with you.
Yeah.
Speaking of learning and books, let's talk about rewriting the playbook. So Kim is distancing himself from past engagement patterns and he showed little interest in US or South Korean overtures. So, why might Washington's traditional focus on denuclearization no longer be sufficient? You've written
Yeah.
about this recently. In this,
Yeah.
in fact, this piece right here, I was reading on your Get Ready for a Big, Bold, and Very Bad Nuclear North Korea Deal in Foreign Affairs. I'd encourage others to read it. It came out in May.
Yeah, so I didn't pick the title.
You never get
Yeah,
to
you
do
never
that.
do
No,
that. The
you don't get
editors,
to.
they try to pick as, you
Yes,
know,
exactly.
clickbait for titles.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, North Korea, again, public sources has what maybe 50 nuclear weapons and fissile material for maybe 90
Yeah.
nuclear weapons. This is not a ne near-term denuclearization
No, it is not.
effort anymore. When we were doing this in 2005 to 2007, maybe. When the others were doing it in 1994, maybe there were opportunities then, but that's not where we are today. So the question really is, I mean, denuclearization should always be the US objective, but practically speaking, what can we accomplish that won't be a Bolton-esque type, let's just have them turn over all 50 of their nuclear weapons. That and have them transported to our national
Yeah, because they're
assets.
not going to get behind that deal.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. And I think even John Bolton today would admit that that would not happen. So the question is like, what can be done in the interim, and what would be acceptable by from U.S. policy perspective, in terms of the nonproliferation community, in terms of allies and things. And here, this is where, you know, with somebody like Donald Trump. Many things can happen
Yes.
because he is not beholden to any of the traditional policy conventions when it comes to this issue. I think he does believe denuclearization is still important, but he's certainly not going to sit there and say, I'm not doing anything until they denuclearize. So this summit meeting coming up is important between the US and South Korean presidents because perhaps they'll think about a strategy together. We saw in the first set of meetings between the United States and North Korea in Singapore and Hanoi, that the United States still have denuclearization as the objective, a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. But practically speaking, there are big issues ahead that fall short of denuclearization, stopping any more ICBM testing, stopping any more nuclear testing, getting assurances there won't be horizontal proliferation, trying to get a cap on fissile material production. Many of these things would, if I were back in a negotiation, would be things that I were at, would be after that fall far short of, you know, give us a declaration and let inspectors come in tomorrow and start visiting all the sites and dismantling them. To put that out first as the first negotiating point is just unrealistic. It's absolutely unrealistic. There are many things that could be done before then. That would be important, and that would be important for the security of the United States and for allies.
When I read your piece, which really was a good piece, and I do commend it to the audience. It made me reflect back on a piece I wrote in November of 2020. So it actually came out a day or so before the elections of that year. And I was suggesting a policy approach towards this, and I called it a denuclearization through peace, a policy approach to towards turning North Korea from foe to friend. What did I call it? I got it here 5 years ago. Denuclearization through peace, a policy approach to change North Korea from foe to friend. Because I was looking and saying we were trying to get peace through denuclearization. If we could just denuclearize them, then we'd get peace. And I was saying we've got that flipped. If we get peace we first. Will eventually get to denuclearization. And almost like, you know, the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, Article 6, anyhow, kind of signs all nuclear powers up towards eventual denuclearization or nuclear reduction. And so it's kind of that big goal anyway. And so, you know, when there's a rationale toward it, made me think back on it. You clearly, though, recognize the, you know, the transactional nature of what's at hand and how we need to see what's achievable and stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, your piece, there are others, like I remember Ambassador Jim Laney was another, and Ambassador Jim Goodby was another one who was putting forward this idea of we need to change the political relationship first before we can get to denuclearization. Not that it would become necessarily that much easier, but it's hard to try to negotiate weapons between two highly distrustful countries.
Yes.
And there are two no more highly distrustful countries than the US and DPRK, and that you need to do something to change the political relationship. And I think even later, people like Bill Perry recognize this as well. And I think, you know, to his credit, Donald Trump in Singapore and Hanoi was trying to do that. He was trying to establish a relationship with the North Korean leader, really change the tone before getting to harder issues. So, I mean, we're not anywhere near a return to that diplomacy just yet. But I think it's a thesis that needs to be seriously tested because everything else we've tried has not worked, right? So I think we have to be open to new and perhaps even radical ideas. Because what we've done so far for the last 40 years, I mean, the evidence of our success is in North Korea's weapons program today, which is much more advanced and much more capable than it was, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago. And as you know well, they are moving with great intent and with great purpose to try to develop a survivable capability, right? Yeah. And if they ever get to that point, then we can really kiss denuclearization goodbye.
I remember, 2004, maybe three. Excuse me. Graham Allison was real kind. He, in his New York Times article, book review of Gallucci et al., his book, he'd mentioned my book that had come out a year or so before that on the denuclearization of North Korea. And I, like you, I've been looking at this a long time. It is a this is a problem that if there were easy answers, we'd have had them already.
That's right. That's right. And the other thing I think is that there's always been a tendency in the criticism of U.S. policy towards North Korea to say, well, if the United States just did a little bit differently, we could get a better outcome. Or if the United States, you know, I don't know, if they, you know, if he was nicer to Kim Jong-un, if we sat down with him early on, that this would all be solvable. And these sorts of criticisms, aside from the partisan ones, would often come from people who are experts, but who haven't really been engaged as you or I have been in this problem. And if you've been engaged as you or I have been in this problem, one of the first lessons you learn is that you need two to tango.
Yes.
It's not just the United States.
That's
of course, we can change our policy, but if the other party is not interested in denuclearization, there's very little that you can really change aside from capitulating that might get you closer to your goal. So that's often something I think that is misunderstood about this negotiation over the years.
And to complicate it more, there's got to be at least three constellations and maybe more. South Korea is, you know, who the president there makes a big difference, just like who the president of the United States, and without a doubt, the other players as well. And so with that, maybe a transition, we'll talk about one of these other players, China. And they have been sidestepped, I think. And so Beijing appears to have lost its once dominant role as North Korea's main partner and its patron. And so what are the consequences of China's diminished leverages over Pyongyang, and who's filling that gap now?
Yeah, so clearly Russia is filling that gap in terms of your second question. The consequences, I think, are quite significant. Well, first, I think that the nature of this new relationship with DPRK and Russia, as your question suggests, really has reduced China's influence in North Korea. I think China's general stance toward North Korea was to help it, but help it just enough to keep it on its feet, don't allow it to collapse, but not help it too much that it would feel like it had a blank check from Beijing. I think that has kind of been where China has always been. And they're all, at the same time, they're also very jealous of any who get too close to North Korea. So before the current iteration with Russia, it was the United States during Trump's first administration, where Trump said he would meet with the North Korean leader. You know this well, but up until Trump's announcement that he was willing to meet the North Korean leader, Xi Jinping had not met with Kim Jong-un once, once.
But and he came into office in December of 12, right?
Right,
December 11, I guess, is when his father died, right? He came into office.
Right.
So,
So, you know, a good bit of time where he had not met the North Korean leader. But in the period between Trump's announcement and I think the first summit, Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un met some like maybe five times.
Right.
It was some rather large.
Yeah, it was not insignificant.
Yeah. So China sort of keeps its hand on North Korea, but it also doesn't want anybody to get too close. And in fact, after the failure in Hanoi, the Hanoi summit, after that, Xi Jinping stopped meeting with Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
Now, Kim Jong-un clearly has a new friend in Russia.
He does.
And the Chinese have been sidestepped or sidelined. They're trying to build back some of their relationship with North Korea now, largely through trade, I think. But they don't have the sort of handle on North Korea that they did in the past. Why this is consequential for the United States and allies is that I think that for better or for worse, even though we were often frustrated with China and not exercising their influence on North Korea more towards our goal of denuclearization, the one thing that they always did, mostly subtly, was that they tried to prevent the North Koreans from getting too aggressive or being too adventuristic. They would, you know, try to ensure that there would not be a seventh nuclear test or things that were especially provocative. Maybe they weren't successful all the time, but in retrospect, they exhibited some sort of regulatory influence over North Korean behavior. I think the real consequence for the United States, aside from the weapons and the war in Ukraine and all these sorts of things, is that I think we're in a we're really now in a period of unregulated North Korean behavior. That the Russians, I don't think, exercise the same sort of, and I put quotation marks, responsibility over North Korean behavior like the Chinese did. Even though we may not see the Chinese as being very helpful, I think that was, compared to the Russians, that's something that they did a little bit more of. And I don't think the Russians do any of that. If anything, they're just encouraging the North Koreans to do more. And so, you know, asking them to send 10, 20,000 troops, right? These are big, major steps. And I'm sure that Chinese are not happy with it, but they haven't said anything about it, really. And so this, I think, is a major consequence of this relationship where China has been sort of bypassed.
I want to pull on this just a little bit further. You've gone into this a bit, but we're talking about the strategic dilemma. And so, excuse me, so the policy toolkit, I mean, it seems a bit depleted. Diplomacy is stalled, deterrence is under strain, military options remain off the table. Tick, 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 tick. So what explains the current strategic dilemma in U.S. and allied approaches to North Korea? We've got here we are. And so what's, what do you think?
There's not much to work with,
Yeah, there's not much to
frankly.
work with.
The South Koreans, we have a new government in South Korea. They've taken some initial steps to de-escalate, right? They got rid of the
Yep.
loudspeakers. They said that they are not seeking to absorb North Korea. They've tried to make a number of de-escalatory moves. North Koreans are not really interested at all, it appears, at least right now. And then all of our data shows that even in periods of inter-Korean engagement, those don't necessarily correlate with great reduction in North Korean belligerent behavior, whether that's testing or development or anything else. So I don't think there's anything there. With regard to Japan, they've always talked about getting back to the Pyongyang Declaration that Koizumi did, Prime Minister Koizumi
2000 or
did.
something.
Yeah, but there's no movement there. There's no movement on abductees either.
No.
The Chinese. They're not going to increase sanctions on North Korea to our benefit because that's just going to push the North Koreans closer to the Russians, which is not what they want. If anything, they're using carrots. They're trying to engage North Korea to bring them more to their side. And that is just another reason for them not to talk to us. And then, of course, in addition to all the material support, Russia and China are fine with not enforcing the sanctions regime. So there aren't the traditional tools that we use. I know some of our friends, like Anthony Ruggiero and others, would say, no, there's still sanctions tools we can use. Maybe there are secondary sanctioning and things of that nature. But the other piece of this that was not there before is that we have an interest. I mean, to the extent we want the war in Ukraine to stop and we don't want Russia to do more, we have an interest in trying to incentivize North Korea not to continue to be the munitions supplier for Russia. So that has to be taken into account too. So you're right, the policy toolkit, the tools that we're familiar with, just they don't seem to work anymore. And so we have to start thinking about what else we can possibly do.
So I want to pull on something I heard you say recently. I mean, you proposed or talked about this layered pressure strategy of diplomacy, coordination with China, inter-Korean engagement, a psychological operation. So can entrapment succeed where incentive threats have failed? What do you think?
I don't know, but I think it's worth trying because
Yeah.
we don't really have anything else. We've talked about this. I think not a lot of tools, but I think there's one vulnerability in the DPRK Russia
Okay.
relationship, and that is if they become too close, if they become so close that we get to a point where North Korea starts feeling like it's entrapped in the relationship with Russia. And by entrapment, we mean Russia starting to take or assume or take for granted that North Korean military support will always be there. So the Russians looking for the North Koreans to deploy near the Baltics or in other sorts of contingencies where Russia may have other designs. That sort of thing could be a red line for North Korea. I mean, getting involved potentially in a conflict with a NATO ally, I don't know if that's something that the North Koreans want to do. In addition to that, even if the Russians aren't pushing in that direction, information warfare, right? Disinformation to try to get the North Koreans, the sort of innate paranoia that North Korea has about being dominated by great powers. Right, that is where Chuch'e
Yes.
ideology comes from, right? The fear of domination by others, whether that's with China or whether that's with Russia, in this case with Russia, trying to ignite that sort of paranoia. Perhaps the North Koreans already feel it a little bit today.
Definitely, yeah.
And that could be something that would be done with both the North Koreans and with the Chinese. Get the Chinese to believe that the North Koreans are getting way, way too close to the Russians. So, it's far from a perfect and foolproof strategy, but in these sorts of situations when we don't have a lot of policy tools, we need to look at what are some of the innate vulnerabilities in that relationship, and I think this is one of them.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
We've got, we have a global audience with Dialogue. We've got, in fact, 35 countries, people from 35 countries that are tuned in today on this show. And so we've got a lot of audience questions, and I'm going to try to tick through a few of these.
Sure.
We won't go through all of them, but we'll get through some. And so this first question is kind of asking us about this post-war projection. So where might DPRK warfighting experience be directed after the Ukraine war ends?
Well, certainly that the warfighting capability and what they learned from Ukraine is going to be applied 100% on the Korean Peninsula. I think many of these people who come back from the war will have a favored position in the North Korean military. Just as we saw when South Koreans came back from the Vietnam War, you know, that basically made up the core of the ROK leadership, military leadership, uniform leadership going forward. So I certainly expect we'll see that in the case of DPRK. Whether that capability is used elsewhere, you know, it depends on what the Russians want to do. Like if the Russians do see an opportunity, maybe they will look for North Korea to be part of some other force that they pre-position someplace else. Or maybe there will be new relationships and military exercising that will take place between DPRK and Russia. I mean, I think that this relationship has come, as you know well, a long way from 2022, but it still could go a lot further,
yes, it could.
Right? It could. And so, you know, this is probably the biggest change. It's certainly the biggest change that's happened among the four great powers and the two Koreas in decades, that is strategically significant, not just for South Korea, but also for the United States, because of this relationship, we don't only have to worry about DPRK on the peninsula, we now have to worry about DPRK in Europe.
We do.
Like, who would have thought that? And because of this relationship, we don't just have to worry about Putin in Europe, we have to worry about Putin providing all this capability, high-end military technology to North Korea on the peninsula and for homeland security. So these were things that we really, these additional dimensions were things that we didn't really have to think about before.
We have, North Korea exports a lot of labor. And we're doing this long before this, and that was one of the factors of the UNSCRs is try to pull all that labor back. And I've now been thinking, you can see military advisors or trainers being part of this deployed workforce that going forward in different parts of the world.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And then, you know, the other element that I'm sure will grow that we haven't talked about is sort of cyber cooperation.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's another space where we know the North Koreans have been very active. And whether they're able to operate out of Russia or whether there are things that they're going to do together, you know, this is extremely concerning because, as Ann Neuberger said during the Biden administration, this has moved from petty theft, as it was during COVID, largely to get cash because they were cut off from the entire world, including China, to being things that are now more strategic, very clearly, that the funds are being used not just for cash, but for financing proliferation.
I'll give our colleague Gene Lee a shout out here. You brought up cyber, and this weekend, just listened to latest episode. There is a next in the next season, I guess, but on Lazarus Heist, and it's a really good treatment of understanding North Korea's cyber crime, criminal activity going on. And she goes into depth about the $1.5 billion that they just pulled out of a cyber heist. And you mentioned it also in your article. And so commend that to the audience as well. Multipolar ambitions is this next question. So is North Korea's alignment with Russia part of a broader strategy to engage in a multipolar world?
I think that this is certainly one of the things that one of the lessons they may have learned from this engagement with Russia. I mean, like, again, I think it really started out as very tactical. They had an opportunity to make some money, to sell some munitions. But this is now, as you know well, been talked about as part of a multipolar network now of, we at CSIS, we call it, it's our CRINC, what we call the CRINCs project.
You want to go ahead and define that?
Yeah, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, that in some cases very tightly coordinated, like DPRK in Russia. In other cases, maybe less coordinated, but that there is an opportunity now for this network to grow. And they all need each other in one way or another. Even after the US strikes on Iran, the Iranians may look to the Russians for help. The Russians may be able to say, look, we'd be happy to help you, but go to the North Koreans. They can be really helpful. So there are these sorts of networks that are emerging as a result of the war in Ukraine, and the frankly, the collapse of global governance institutions that have made this that have helped to create this network. And all the parties in it clearly see advantage to engaging in it, North Korea being one of the biggest beneficiaries.
Yeah, and I have a feeling we're just getting started on this,
Yeah, I
unfortunately.
agree. I agree. I agree. And I think, for example, on Iran and the strikes on Iran, I mean, on the one hand, that could be seen as a deterrent for North Korea, like they don't want to suffer the same fate. On the other hand, it wouldn't surprise me if the Iranians looked to the North Koreans to help them reconstitute their capability. And it wouldn't surprise me either if the North Koreans, and of course, I don't have access to the classified bomb damage assessments, but if the North Koreans walk away from that case and say, huh, like they still have fissile material, they still have this, that, and the other thing, despite the fact that we dropped all these bombs on them, the North Koreans are going to feel emboldened by that. They're not going to feel deterred. They're going to feel emboldened by that. The US took a big shot and they weren't able to take it all out. And we're buried even deeper than the Iranians are.
By
So
far.
it's and so that sort of information sharing that's taking place has repercussions. They within that network have repercussions for our deterrence and defense strategy on the peninsula.
Well, I'm going to pull right into that then. This next one's asking about battlefield lessons learned. So, what lessons, militarily, technologically, operationally, is North Korea gaining from the Ukraine conflict?
Yeah, well, we don't, I mean, we, at least we on the outside, don't have access to a lot of that information. But, clearly they've learned that aspects of their military that might have been considered anachronistic are still very much in play, right? Whether you're talking about munitions, ground wars, dug-in trenches, artillery, artillery fights, things that were part of a 1950s type war have been shown in the war in Ukraine to be very relevant to the future. And so I think the North Koreans certainly learned that. Of course, it also means they've also learned about drone technology. They're pretty advanced in terms of their own, but there's a lot of drone technology sharing that can take place again within this network, Iran and North Korea, Russians, Chinese microelectronics. There are a lot of things coming out of this war that the North Koreans will learn that will make them much better as war fighters, and much more formidable for South Korea, the United States, and Japan.
This next question pulls a little bit on, I think, ground we've been, but you may have something else to say on it. It's asking about the China calculus. So, what is China's position on the growing Russia-North Korea partnership?
So I've tried to watch this fairly closely, and what's striking to me about it is that, at least publicly, the Chinese have not changed their stance. They've used effectively the same talking point, whether we were talking about when the Biden administration first announced the arms transfer to the Wagner Group and released imagery. You remember that? They released imagery of it. When the Chinese were asked about it, they said, this is a bilateral issue between DPRK and Russia, and like we have nothing to say about it. 2 years later, there's ev the Ukrainians are providing evidence of North Korean missile parts that are after attacks in Ukrainian territory. There's video footage of North Korean troops training, being supplied, being attacked by drones. Chinese get the same reports of billions of dollars of munitions going back and forth, as you said, 6 million rounds, if not more. And the Chinese have the same talking point. It's astounding. So to me, that either meant one of two things. One is that the Chinese are either incapable of affecting the situation, and that's why they use this anodyne talking point, or two, e either incapable or two, that they are incompetent in the sense that they don't know what to do, that they cannot make a decision within their own system. And so they just stay with the same talking point for 2+ years.
Interesting.
I don't know which of these is true right now, but I think by most calculations, there's certainly something where the Chinese can see benefit from this. If it's complicating our security picture, I'm sure they see benefit to that. But I cannot imagine that they see it in the long term in their interest for North Korea, obviously to engage in a war in the middle of Europe, but also basically scuttling all of their relations with the European Union. I mean, part of this decision to supply Russia was a decision by North Korea to basically say, we're willing to sacrifice all of our relations with European countries. Because as you know well from the opening under Kim Dae-jung, when under the Sunshine Policy, you know, virtually all EU countries reestablished diplomatic relations. And the North Koreans traditionally looked at Europe as sort of the more friendlier gateway to the West than clearly the United States and or South Korea, Japan. So all sorts of cultural programs, economic exchanges, things like this, all that I think has effectively been shut down, not just because of COVID shutdown, but because of the way they've behaved in the war in Ukraine. The Europeans see them as adversaries now. Yeah. They don't see them as potential partners. Yeah. And so I can't imagine that the Chinese see that as positive either. But they appear to have done nothing on this. And I know that in U.S.-China bilaterals, the previous administration, we haven't had a bilateral between the United States and China under Trump too, but the previous administration really tried hard to move the Chinese on this issue, whether it was Resolution 1718 on the sanctions. They really tried to get the Chinese on side on this, and they just couldn't do it. Not for lack of effort, but because the Chinese, again, either they're incapable or they're incompetent, one or the other. So.
I think I'll pull on one more question given time. And this one's asking about alliance implications. So if these developments make the Kim regime more secure, what impact will they have on the inter-Korean relations and the U.S.-ROK alliance?
So again, I think it's going to be harder to foster dialogue with North Korea. In retrospect, I think many of us believe that North Korea engages in dialogue with the United States or in South Korea, not necessarily from a position of strength. Rhetorically, they say they're in a position of strength, but materially, it's usually because they need something. You know, sanctions lifting, inter-Korean fertilizer, whatever it is. They usually need something from either the United States or South Korea. And right now, they feel like they don't need anything. And it's been very clear, at least in the initial responses to the Lee government, the lack of response to some of the things that the U.S. president has said, some of the messages that they've dropped. We'll see as we get closer to APEC whether there'll be an opportunity, you know, as, you know, President Trump famously, an impromptu moment, told Kim Jong-un to meet him in Panmunjom. When was that? 2019. As we get closer to APEC, which is in Gyeongju in South Korea, you know, will there be another Panmunjom moment?
Could happen.
We don't know. But right now, the signals are not very strong coming from North Korea. And I think that's because they feel that they're in a strong position. Not that they're in a weak position, but that they're in a strong position right now.
Oh, my goodness. Victor, this has been an amazing hour together. I wish it hadn't have flown by so quickly.
No, I appreciate it.
The audience is so much better for having had the opportunity to listen to you and share all this experience. And I want to take a minute to highlight some of the work you've done. I take this segment of the show and we talk about a book or so, and I want to take this time real quickly to highlight some of the work you've been doing. And oh my goodness, it's like the book a year marathon that you're on. And I want you to you have to correct me because I know I don't have it all. And I know you're working on a book right now. I'm going to let you talk about that. But I've got on my bedside the North Korea C-based WMD capabilities that you did with Joe Bermudez, guy that has been in this field a very long time.
Yes.
In 20, last year you did the black box, you know, just demystifying the study of Korea's unification and the North Korea. Very timely with all of the "we're not going to do unification anymore" rhetoric that was coming out of the North. And then the year before that, you and Ramon Pardo did the Korea, A New History of South and North. It reminded me of Obrador's book.
Yes.
And that book needed way updated because it was the 90s that came out. You've got another book coming up. Talk a little bit about some of this work
yeah,
that you got
sure,
going.
sure. So we're very happy with the book that Ramon Pacheco Pardo and I did, the history book on Korea. It's a great introductory text for people who want to learn more about Korea. We find the audience has really been a lot of people around the world who are actually drawn to Korea by culture, particular modern culture, K-pop, Netflix, movies, TV shows. They're accessing the book because they love the sort of pop culture side of Korea and they want to learn more about its history and things. The Black Box book I did with a number of colleagues at CSIS and some of my graduate students, really trying to unpack how we think about unification. It's probably the least understood of anything, even more so than North Korea, least understood just because it's a contingency that you can't really prepare for. I mean, militaries prepare for military contingencies, but something like unification is and its aftermath is not something that's governments have the time to or the resources to spend thinking about. So we tried to do some of that. The CBS WMD book again is, you know, our concern about North Korea's drive for a survivable nuclear capability, which would be a watershed moment if they achieved that. And even after that book was written, we saw Kim Jong-un openly stating that his ambition is to have a nuclear-powered submarine. In fact, he visited some prototype of a nuclear-powered submarine. And then the book that's coming out next year, early next year, is actually not on Korea. It's more broadly on the question of the weaponization of trade. Now, when we talk about this today, people often point to the United States, right? We're weaponizing trade with reciprocal tariffs and things like this. But by far the biggest weaponizer of trade over the past decade and a half has been China. So it's really a book about what China has done to weaponize trade against 16 governments and over 500 companies. We have the most comprehensive data set of Chinese economic coercion. And what sort of strategy that the Western world can take to combat that.
Thank you for that. And thank you for being here on a morning where you got up at 3 to do your own podcast, The Impossible State.
Yeah.
You still found time to come in here late in the afternoon. That means a lot. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. It's great to be on the dialogue with you. And thank you to all your listeners.
And we'll have you with an open invitation to come back anytime.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you. As we conclude today's dialogue, we've seen how North Korea's alignment with Russia is reshaping strategic realities. And as we've heard today, the consequences extend far beyond the Korean Peninsula. These conversations shape security. Join us on August 25th for the episode 50th, the 50th episode, The ROK-US Alliance, The Near Future, when I sit down with Dr. Clint Work to explore what lies ahead for this vital alliance. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for being part of this important dialogue. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha hoi. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.